Welcome to Executives After Hours, real conversations with real leaders. This is your host, Dr. James Kelly. I want to make you a promise that over the next 60 minutes, you will learn at a minimum two things. One, every leader and executive makes mistakes on the way to the top. And two, and more importantly, everyone has a unique story to tell. And that's what we do here on Executive After Hours. We sit down with leaders across a variety of industries, and we talk to them about their unique story. So welcome to the community, and stay tuned for today's episode on your Executives After Hours. Hello, everybody. Welcome to Executives After Hours. Well, today's show is one of these surprise shows where you just don't really know what you're getting until you get into it. And I had the pleasure of interviewing Stephen Robertson. Stephen is the CEO of the Julian Krinsky summer camps, tennis clubs. And for those of you who aren't in Philadelphia, it is a major summer camp organization where kids from all over the world, counselors from all over the world come and focus on sports like golf and soccer and robotics and speaking and everything. So it's a very robust camp, and it's one of these places that people send their kids right before university, maybe their sophomore year, junior year, even younger though, to have a global experience, to see what the world is like. And to see college campuses, because these are all held on college campuses. But more importantly, to be honest with you, Steve is just hilarious. The guy is so open and so honest and so South African that it was just a pleasure and just awesome to speak with him. So today's episode is Stephen Robertson, CEO of Julian Krinsky Summer Camps and Tennis Club. Also, please leave a review on iTunes. Thank you to my content partner, C-Suite Radio. I'm trying to hurry because the music's ending fastly. So everyone have an awesome week. I've had a lot of coffee. And thank you so much. And see you! Philadelphia, honestly, was a surprise city for my wife and I. Like, total surprise.
For us, too. So tell me what happened. So how long were you here?
7 years.
Okay. We've been here 18 years. Wow. I've been to, I think, probably 40 of the 50 states, and I'm lucky to travel a bunch. I've been to Dubai, and I've got a really good friend there, actually. I'd love you guys to connect. He's amazing. But I never thought for a second this is where we'd end up staying, but I've honestly fallen in love with it on many many fronts, should I say.
Why is
that?
I
love the sport. I love the culture. I'm out in the suburbs. I'm not in the city, so it does. Yeah. But it's close enough to New York and Washington and the beach and the mountains, and so – yeah, for right now, we're 18 years later, we're still enjoying it.
I feel like the term right now may not be appropriate. So,
well said.
Well, so I can tell this is going to be a fantastic conversation. So just to kind of give my audience a quick 10,000-foot view of who you are, or in your parlance, I'll say 3,000-meter view. Can you please just kind of state who you are, who you work for? And I know in the Philadelphia area, it's a quite prevalent company.
Yeah. So thank you for saying that. I'm glad you know us. We thought we were the best kept secret. So I'm Steve Robertson. At the moment, I am the CEO of the Julian Krinsky Group, which includes Julian Krinsky Camps and Programs. And Julian Krinsky is the name on the door. The founder started this business 40 years ago and is still around. And so, yeah, that's who I am. We run a range of different summer camps and programs as one of the things that we do for – we're all about 40 this year. So for we see students from more than 40 different countries, 40 different states, and we are 40 years old this year. So
it's pretty massive. I'm just saying, like, because I used to live in a little suburb, which you'll know, Ardmore, and I backed up against Haverford College. So I was there all the time during the summers in the camps, and you would just see the international camp counselors and students, and it's for my audience who's in the States, who's ever thinking about sending their kids to a camp, I won't mention the price side of it, but it is a really fantastic multicultural environment.
Thank you.
Yeah. So we had always thought about sending our kids there when they got older, if we were still there, but we're not. So,
but you still can, because we get kids from your area too. So come on.
Fair enough. and maybe in the summer. So next summer we're going to go out there and we're talking about renting an RV and doing a 2-month drive of the US. So
that sounds awesome.
So, all right. So I got to obviously just to, we'll unpack Krinsky, Julian Krinsky, a little bit later, but I need to unpack how you ended up to Philadelphia from South Africa. So tell me, like, what part of South Africa are you from?
So originally Johannesburg. Mm-hmm. And if you've ever visited, it's a lovely city, but probably one I wouldn't recommend as the top city. Cape Town is just a spectacular destination, and there's a bunch of fun places that you could go to. Grew up in Johannesburg, and I a huge sports fan, played a lot of sports, did what sports? I needed to. So anything you can imagine. I was particularly good, in my mind anyway, at tennis. And
isn't that how it always is?
Yeah, that's all that counts, right? I thought I was really good. Tennis. I played. I really loved and still do cricket. I played rugby, of course, soccer. But having now become a Philadelphia fan, I am absolutely crazy about the Eagles. So I'm crazy about American football too. So I grew up there. Went to college, studied teaching. Never taught a day in my life. Education. Never taught a day in my life. We had conscription, so I went straight into the army. And after the army, which I wasn't a huge fan of, but I really value the people that do serve. I worked in a diamond business, which sounds like everybody in South Africa should do, but I became the international sales director for a company based out of Israel, but I was in South Africa, and I was in that space for quite a while. Oh, actually, it wasn't that long, probably 18 months, and decided that it wasn't a great fit for me. Just the culture is a little bit intense around the diamond industry. And then I pursued a tennis coaching, I was going to say career. I went through the process of becoming a qualified tennis coach in South Africa, and after a short period of time got quite high up in that process. And so established a really or was part of a very nice tennis business in South Africa that had beautiful franchise opportunities, and we ran leagues across the country and such. And I ended up owning that. And it was through that I ended up coming for a visit with a group of really talented tennis students over to America. We brought them over to play a number of different tournaments. At the time, there was a gentleman by the name of Craig Tiley, who's actually an ex-South African guy, who was the head coach or the coach of Illinois, of their tennis team, and he did incredibly well with their tennis team. Today, he's the director, and I may have said his title incorrectly, but he runs the Australian Open Tennis, and he's in charge of tennis development in Australia, and they're doing incredibly well. Wonderful guy. So we got to visit there with some of the students, and then came by Philadelphia because I had a connection here. Ended up meeting Julian Krinsky, and fast forward, he offered me an opportunity to come and join his team. Went home, spoke to my wife about it. I had two really young kids at the time. She cried for a month because we'd have to give up everything that we thought we were in love with there. The friends and the home and the business and all those things, and decided to come. So we came over. I started working as a tennis coach with the camps and the program. So we own two indoor tennis clubs in the Philadelphia area. So as well as obviously a tennis camp is one of the things that we do. And I was in that position for probably 18 months. And then before they realized I didn't know what I was doing, which is great. I stayed under the radar. And then I was very fortunate. Julian and his business partner, Adrian, they took a chance on me and they said, do you want to get involved in a different area? And I took over the HR for the business, which is kind of a big deal because we bring in, 400 or 500 people from around America, around the country, around the world to work with us every summer, plus our internal HR. So I was going through that whole process of learning what that looked like in the American context and formalized some of those things. It didn't take long, and I added the IT of the business to that portfolio. And next thing I was in charge of operations. And so mobilizing all our camps, all the different venues that we run them at, University of Pennsylvania, Villanova, Haverford, as you mentioned, mm-hmm. and we've even done some things in other states. We're at Yale as well and a couple of other spaces. And now I'm in a position as the CEO, helping part owner, helping, you know, determine the future and the vision of the business. So it's pretty exciting.
All right. So I'm going to pump the brake a little bit here and back on up. Beep, 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 beep. So that was a lot of information dump. So let me start with just kind of life in South Africa. So, so basically we're going back to the beginning. But what I want to try to understand then is, first of all, why did you pursue sports? And was when you were growing up, were sports integral in your life, meaning your siblings, your family? Because it's obviously a central part of what you do now.
Yeah. So that's a great question on so many levels. So I'm the baby in a family of three siblings. So I have two older sisters. And it's just great being the baby. I just feel like I was spoilt, and I should have been, because I was the third, and it was just wonderful. My sisters, because I was the only boy, it was even better. I convinced my sisters that my parents were always trying to have a boy, and that's why they eventually stopped with me. And the first two didn't go as well because they were girls. And
psychological warfare at a young age.
I know, right? anything you have to with siblings, it can be tough sometimes. So you know, the culture, the South African culture was, still is, was very outdoors, very sport oriented.
And so that's really similar to Australia, by the way.
Very much. Yeah. Correct. Yeah. Yeah. So we have a lot in common from that perspective. There's really no doubt about that. So I grew up, we had to play sport at school, and it was great for me. And yeah, I guess like most boys, I didn't really care too much about school work, but I did what I had to get by. And I loved being out and playing sports. So that's, you know, that's why I spend as much time on the sports field.
So do you think that in South Africa, it's, because this is kind of a big debate that I have about sports in the US in general, a big debate. In my head, it's a big debate. I don't think anyone gives a shit really, but in my mind, it's massive. But, you know, in Australia, for example, so tell me if South Africa is similar. Sport is embedded in life, not as a means to an end. And I feel like in the US, it's a means to an end, resulting in a lot of burnouts, a lot of unhealthy behaviors later in life, a lot of sports injuries because everyone's using the same sport for 20, 30 years. So do you think South Africa, sport is a way of life, not an ends to a mean? And so you were expected to do sport, not only because you were probably in a British system where you do sport automatically, but, right, but meaning like your mom and dad are like, you're doing sport because that's what you do because it's healthy and it's a lifestyle.
So, wow, that's just really an interesting perspective. There is, so I think a lot of what you're saying is true. I do think the only thing I would maybe differ on is that back then, meaning when I was a little younger, and I'm only a Gen Zer, so I'm not ancient. I mean, I'm Xer. Gee, I'm not a Gen Zer. No, not at all. In fact, I'm a Gen Xer. I love Gen Zers because that's who I work with. Wow, that was a Freudian slip.
No, you're bubbly like a Gen Z. You've got the energy of a Gen Z. So technically, just by energy level, we subtract years from Gen X, and you just get to the top end of Gen Z. So you're right. Don't worry
about
it.
I love that. Thank you, Dr. James Kelly. That was well done. Yeah, it was definitely a part of the culture as opposed to being potentially a means to an end. I think what's changed now is that we have parents that are significantly more involved. Where I grew up, it was a case of both my parents worked. My mom was an accountant, my father's an engineer, and they both went to work. And it was completely fine for me to go to school, walk to school, you know, probably a kilometer, and walk back after I've participated in my sport. I could go meet my friends at the tennis courts and play. And so it was very much an easy environment to grow up in. Whereas now I feel like parents are significantly more involved in every aspect of their kids' lives.
Micromanaging?
Yes. Yeah. And so look, there's some real good parts to that, even if it's only one. But you know, I think if it's done well, it can be really, really healthy. But, you know,
sorry, the word if, because I feel like it's usually when they're hands on like that, it's the other side of it that comes out.
Yeah. You know what this, I really think the saddest thing is, and I see a lot of families that do an amazing job with their kids. Mm-hmm. So I don't think this is, you know, an epidemic, but I can tell you that over-involved parents, I don't think they always realize that the end result when their kids do eventually leave school with college and get their first job, the damage, and damage makes it sound like it's not something that you can repair. I think they've set them back so badly. It's just really unfair. And I don't think parents, I think their intentions are often very good.
Oh, totally.
But and if they just had to think it through a little bit more, they realize that they're really limiting their kids' potential and truthfully just their growth, and they're stunting their growth. And I think that's kind of what we're seeing now, where that people are hyper-focused in, you know, wanting to be their tennis champion. Because I was good in tennis in my own mind, I could have done one of two things. I could have really pushed my kids to play tennis, come hell or high water. And we own a tennis club, so the price would have been right, you know, all those things. So, you know, it wouldn't have been a financial hurdle. But I chose not to. I chose to let them self-determine. Now I look back a little bit and I'm like, oh, maybe I should have, maybe I shouldn't have. Maybe there was some kind of balance between a little bit of hands-off and really forcing them, and maybe the common ground in between was really where it should have been. But I think that, you know, from where I grew up to where we are today, there's a very different approach to, as you suggested, sport, even academics, even just every component of what your child does and how that child is brought up. And
so I guess this kind of leads me to a question. I'm really curious because, you know, when you think about – and again, my only data point is Australian parents – but I feel like Australia and South Africa are very similar in a lot of ways. So, like, did you and your wife? Well, first of all, I was trying to think of ways to phrase these questions. and there's a long. I got like 4 hours sleep last night, and I have 3 interviews tonight. So I'm like, my mind is like 100 miles an hour. So my own banishment, I guess. But do you think that like? When you were leaving for South Africa, so I have 2 questions here. So we'll start with the first one, because I was thinking about this while you were talking. When you left South Africa to come to the U.S. and your wife is in tears, you've got 2 little kids, you have a business. Was there any moment in that whole process where you thought, this is a really stupid idea? Or were you guys like, let's just give it – like, did you sell your business or like, did you just come and – say we're going to be here 2 years and go back. Like, I don't know. I'm just trying to understand that play because to me that's a significant choice to leave your family, your friends, everything to come to Philadelphia for an unknown and to close a business. I mean, I think there's just a lot of complexity in that choice.
So if we'd only second-guessed ourselves once, it would have been 1,000,000 times. I think we must have probably changed our minds 10 times a day. We're not going. After having committed to going, we must have changed our minds. I can't tell you how many times. And truthfully, moving to America, we did sell our business, which was a really successful sale of the business, although our money was worth nothing trying to get it out of the country. And trying to get money out of the country was a bit of a joke. But still, it was a great process. And even the first month or two here,
what was the tipping point? Like, so you go back and forth 10,000 times. What was the tipping point to go? When your business sold? You're like, we're screwed?
Yeah. that does tend to make things happen quicker. No, the bottom line was, you know, and I hesitate to go here because it becomes a kind of a political conversation and that's not my heart. But we had to try and make a determination growing up in South Africa for our kids.
It's complex.
When they get to the age where they are today, my daughter is now just completed her second year at university, and my son graduated last year, 1 year ago, and he's working successfully in California. We had to, at that time, 18, 19 years ago, we had to say, what do we think would really be the best option for our kids. And whether we were right or wrong, the way we assessed it at that time was that if we were able to make a successful move here to the United States, and I'm very entrepreneurial, so I didn't doubt that we would be successful, but it still makes it a difficult choice. We just felt that it would be so much more opportunities for our kids. And so ultimately, that's what we made the decision on. I try and remind my kids of that all the time. Like, you don't know what I gave up for you.
Because like, the reality is that, like, you just made a really good point earlier. Like, you sold your business quite successful for essentially nothing in U.S. dollars to come and almost start from scratch again.
Literally from scratch. The first.
That is such a complex, like, emotional. Man, you must have really loved your kids. You know, you could have sold one and just got a bunch of cash straight away. Like,
I have tried. I have tried. It's not as easy as you think.
So that kind of leads me to my second question, though. And this is more about current day or over the 18 years. Did you and your wife, as you're trying to raise your kids, did you see your culture butt up against the U.S. culture of parenting?
So my wife went through education and actually taught very successfully for quite a while. And so one of the considerations, we were really concerned about the American education system coming here and letting our kids grow up in these schools after seeing movies about what goes on in school compared to, as you suggested, the British system. And we were like, oh, what are we in for? The area our kids went to school, as you know it well, we were just really thrilled with
did they
how
go
that
to
altered.
Devon, like Devon Prep or Devon like?
So they grew up in the Tredyffrin Easttown area. And so they ended up going to Conestoga as the high school, which was just rated the best in the country for public great schools. So that part ended up well. But it's a concern coming from a British system. What are we going to – what are they going to be in for? So that worked out well, we believe, and our kids have both grown into two wonderful young people. I'm not even joking. I do often try and remind them, you know, what we gave up for you, but they still don't tidy their rooms. So here we are today. Nothing's changed.
So my audience doesn't obviously know this, so I'll kind of describe the main line to my audience. But the main line is probably about a 10-mile strip up one road, either way, about 5 to 10 miles, if you will, in Philadelphia. And if you look online, it's probably the highest concentration of wealth in the country. A lot of it's old money, but at the further west you go from Philadelphia, the more new money it is. And so the other side of that is that there is a ton of absolutely knocked down, drag out, amazing private schools on the main line.
Oh, yeah.
Did you ever feel the pressure were you ever enticed to send your kids there at all? I mean, I know the school you went to, by the way, is from a public school standpoint, is one of the, like you said, best in the countries. And we had talked about if we were going to live in this city longer to move, we couldn't probably afford a house there, but to move that area towards that.
Yeah.
Area.
So, I think the main line you described well, it was actually, I believe, the train line that ran west of the city, and as the city grew, the more wealthy people followed
Correct.
The train line out.
That's right.
So it's a wonderful, wonderful place. We did discuss potentially sending our kids to one of the private schools, and as you said, there are spectacular private schools in this area. They really are amazing. We felt like the cost was really high. We felt like the public schools were really, really good. And, and you know, just from a mainline perspective, you know, you were saying cultural differences earlier. One of the things that we did do in, I think it was 2008, we took my son and daughter out of school. We got leave for just a little bit more than a month over December, pulled them out of school, and we went to Peru, and we lived in the Amazon jungle with a bunch of young boys, really, that had been kicked out of their homes, and there was a group of people that was looking after them, and we got to stay with them for quite a while. And the reason I did this or planned this kind of immersion experience was I really wanted my children to see that there was more to life than just the main line. I'm not knocking the main line because
it's an amazing thing. But it's very white. Very white.
Yeah, and you just, you know, things that you would never think of Like if you're born into that specific culture that I'm talking about in that area of Peru that we were in the middle of the jungle, if you were a girl, it wasn't long and you were put into prostitution. And if you were a boy, you were kicked out because the family wouldn't want to feed you. And so you wouldn't see things like that. And I do think it's something not enjoyable to see, but I think it does expand who you are as a person. So, yeah, we've tried to do a couple of things like that with our kids to help them realize that culture is an interesting thing, and you can always learn a lot about other cultures, and it's really valuable.
But I guess that didn't answer my original question, which, by the way, I don't know if there actually was one, but I'll try to form a more concise one at this point, that you come from a South African parenting background. You talked about education. And at least in Australia, it's a bit more hands-off with your kids, you know?
Right.
You let your kids kind of be themselves at a much younger age, and I think in the U.S., we're a bit more hands-on, a bit more controlling about what they say and what they do and how they act, at least to a certain point. And that's a generalization. I'm not saying everyone's like that. Did you – in the mainline is a space of overachievers, an area. So did you guys struggle with that as you're raising your kids up and you see the intensity of some of these families and kids and desire for success?
We really did. And I don't know that I would have categorized it exactly like you did, because I hadn't thought it through like that. What I did realize was that coming from South Africa, I thought we would have a lot in common. And I traveled a lot, so I'd been to America a number of times. But I thought we would have – it's different to visit versus move. I thought we would have a lot in common with the Americans. And again, the Northeast is very different from other places in the country. And we ended up in the Northeast, and I realized that we have very little in common. We had very little in common, not even the whole English language, only parts of the English language. that was what was really cool about being a tennis coach to begin with, because I got to connect with I coached Andy Reid's daughter. He was the coach of the Eagles at the time. But I got to hang out with a number of adults and children, Americans, and got to really get a good sense of who they were and what they're about. That really helped a lot. But truthfully, culture-wise, worlds apart. Mm-hmm. So
how do you deal with that? From like a – just even a friendship standpoint, you and your wife. Like how do you guys – because I mean I think one of the knocks on America, and I think it's – and Americans is very – I think it's fairly just, is that we don't culture ourselves on other cultures particularly well. Right. If you're on the main line, you're at one of the three beaches, Sea Isle, Long Island, Avalon, whatever. Right. You have a house there and that's your summer vacation. You go to the beach. You come home during the week. On the weekends, you go to the beach. That's kind of the norm in that area. Right. So.
Yeah.
And so how do you, from a socialized standpoint, I mean, did you find that you just kind of morphed your identity to fit? Or did you guys just survive? And I don't – and that sounds a bit drastic. Like, you know, you guys were – clearly if you hated it, you would have left, right? So yeah. I guess to me there's that push-pull. That's what I'm trying to get to is you know, culturally you can see the differences and it's almost like sandpaper on marble maybe for you. But there was still the something that kept you there. Can you just discuss that a little bit with me?
Maybe a little bit of both. You know, I realized very quickly if I asked for tomato sauce in the restaurant and it took 10 minutes to explain to the server that I was actually looking for ketchup, maybe it was time for me to just say, can I have some ketchup?
Yeah.
And so there are a few things like that changed. But the reality for us was that as we got to connect and engage with the people that we moved with the circles that we moved in, people were really amazing, really welcoming, and were not really looking for us to be someone we weren't. So it made that transition really easy. Our kids obviously grew up. My son, I guess when we got here, he must have been about 4. My daughter was just about to turn 2, something along those lines. And so they picked up the culture from school and the accent really, really quickly. And so that also helped us, you know, morph, if you want to call it that. I think today when I speak to friends and family in South Africa, they think we've changed a little bit more than we feel like we've changed. But it wasn't so difficult. And if I had to say one reason I believe that that's the case is it's very easy to live as a South African in America. I know a lot of South Africans. You know, there's certain cities where there's a great population of immigrants, whether it's South African or Indian or whatever it is, Korean, it doesn't matter. And they end up becoming a little holy huddle and hanging out with each other and being with each other. Whereas we made the determination that if we were going to move here, we were going to move here entirely. And that meant our attitudes, our hearts, our minds, we were going to move everything here. We still look at what's going on in South Africa. We're still connected with people there, obviously. But we were committed completely to making this work. And we realized that part of that attitude was going to be so much part of what we needed to do to be a success here. And I feel like it was that helped us. Not always when we were in South Africa, things were like this. Oh, we did it better when we were there. So we try to stay away from that mindset completely. There's still things we think should change here. We should definitely drive on the other side of the road. That would help, be really helpful. And meters and centimeters would be kilometers would be spectacularly easy to figure out. But by now we figured those out as well as centigrade and Fahrenheit. Yeah.
So, all right. So what I want to do is what university does your daughter go to?
So she's just transferred actually from Miami to Temple. So that's been an interesting change right there. So Temple in Philly, but she was in Miami before.
That's crazy. And then how about your son? Where'd he go?
So he went to a little school in New York called Marymount Manhattan.
Okay.
And he did really well there. He loves New York and will probably move back there when he's done with his training/work. He's on assignment, as it were, in California for a while, so he'll be there.
He'll never go back. California sucks you in.
Oh, yeah. Well, I'm hoping so for his sake.
Yeah. So last question, I'm going to transition to a new segment I have. So you haven't heard this before if you listen to the other one. So
I have not.
You're slightly going to be blindsided on this one. Sorry. but so you said something earlier. We don't have to talk about it. Maybe it was just the words you used and I was just paying too close attention. But you said when we first started talking, I'm CEO for now. So what did you mean by that?
Oh, okay. So I think I want to be I'm just trying to be funny. I'm the CEO. What I meant was that in the foreseeable future, I will be CEO of a business that's very different from where we are now. So that was paying awfully close attention to something that I didn't really mean say.
Fair enough. Fair enough.
I'm not going anywhere. I love where I'm at and I love what we do. So yeah, I'm in good place.
So what I'm going to do is we're going to play my new segment called Let's Get Authentic. It's kind of like a montage to my book coming out, and I figured I should start asking these questions to see if I'm on the right track with my book. So these are five questions, less random than my Fast Five. In fact, very structured.
Okay, I like those Fast Five.
Yeah, they're good. They're good. But I find this a bit interesting from an introspective point of view. So, all right, question one. How do you work on, develop, practice the art of self-awareness?
Wow. Okay.
It's a little bit different than like, what's your first job? I get it. All right. I get it.
Yeah. I was hoping you were going to ask me my favorite, what animal I am. And I was going to say the Loch Ness Monster, because I've got all sorts of cool things to say about that. So I guess probably the best way to answer that is I'm really open to feedback. And I really encourage feedback, not only from people that I work with, but from peers and from friends. And that's probably, you know, off the top of my head, the biggest way that I gauge how I'm doing. I feel like I've interviewed. I'm also one of those. I told you how good I am at sport. I'm also incredibly good at interviewing. Mm-hmm. I've interviewed many, many, many people. I lecture on interviewing at places as well. And so I feel like I'm really good at reading people.
I'd love to get your feedback after this then.
Yeah. I feel like I'm really good at reading people. And so when I ask for and get feedback, I think I'm good at discerning what's real and accurate. And that's probably the most proactive way that I go about trying to get a sense of how I'm doing.
So one of my philosophies that I'm running with in my book, and my wife and I are having a great heated debate about it. And I got to say, my wife is awesome because she's helping me with the book. And I never thought we would actually work on anything together, because early on in our marriage, we probably would have killed each other. but that just tells you the evolution of human beings. So one of my philosophies is that to have a strength in self-awareness, you have to have some sort of crucible, some sort of life event, right? That made you take pause and reflect on who you are, the direction you're going, your values, your personal identity. Did you go through any type of like crucible like that, or have you had a fairly good life? And if you say fairly good, I'm gonna have to text my wife and tell her that you're the example she was talking about today that I debated her with.
No, I feel like there's probably so many of those moments, some big and some small. The move to the U.S. was more difficult than you could imagine. For people that have moved around the world as you have, I think they may have a better sense of what I'm talking about. So that was definitely a moment where I had to and had an opportunity to redefine who I am and have a look at who I am. But you know, I feel like marriage, the birth of a child, any of those significant times for me anyway were times for a real opportunity to reflect. And they don't always have to be negative things. But I've also had run-ins with people. I've also had times where I've done things, I guess on a smaller scale, in a way that I wished I hadn't. Mm-hmm. And, you know, there are a few of those that still today, most of them are positive for me, have been opportunities for me to have another look at who I am and so I would totally say there are many of those moments. I definitely wouldn't say I had just had this easy cruising life and I am who I am today because of that. I totally think I had a whole lot of hard knocks and they made me who I am today.
Awesome. Okay. Question two, how do you use honesty with yourself, but also with people you work with?
So it's funny you say that. We have what we call a culture of honor here, and part of what we talk about internally and even with our staff that are working with us in the summers is how do you honor someone? And part of honoring someone and even being honorable myself, honesty is a significant component of that. Mm-hmm. So I have bumped into many people that are extremely honest, and being extremely honest on its own, I do not believe is very good. I believe, let me say that this way, being honest, but yet delivering that honest message in a way that is user-friendly, that is the key. So, okay. So there are many people that are honest and they just destroy friendships, break hearts and hurt people. And that there's no value in that for me. In fact, I just think that's wrong. Mm-hmm. So part of being honest, we do a lot of that is gives you an opportunity to really coach people. It gives you an opportunity to guide people. But in the work environment, I feel like it's so powerful because it gives people not only a sense of worth, but a sense of safe, non-micromanaging work environment, because you can always have an honest conversation, especially if you deliver it in a way, and I don't want it to sound soppy, but if you deliver it in a way that's delivered in love and out of a place where I'm sharing this with you because I'm calling you into a different destiny. I'm calling you into somebody who I see you as being. And this being honest with you about whatever we're talking about is part of getting you there. So it's not in a destructive way. It's a part of in a way to grow. So we really value being honest with one another. And that's why it comes back both ways. You know, I allow people to be honest with me about what I've said, how I've said it, what I've done. And I receive it coming both ways.
I think, you know, this is an area like, so I'm honest. Now, I'm not the guy who will say like, hey, your butt looks fat in those pants, but but I'm honest in a way that my delivery is something I have to constantly work on, you know, and as Mary will tell you straight, you know, she was raised.
I'm going to be calling her. Yeah, delivery is everything.
And I know this is something that I'm working on. And she'll tell you I'm also way better than I used to be. And I think when you're married, it's kind of a different dynamic at times as well. But I have my core philosophy with honesty is really like, and I'm not a super religious guy, but from basically one of the Ten Commandments, like do unto others as you want done to you. So that's how I think of honesty is, would I want to hear this from someone? Would I want to be told what I want to tell the person, right? Like, would it impact me? Does that make sense? Like if I said to you, hey, Steve, you know, I really appreciate how hard you're working on this project. However, this is what needs to be done better, or this is the change. Some people don't want to have that confrontation because they're worried about it. Where I think, well, I would want to know that because that's only helping me do better at my job.
I love what you're saying, and I feel like that opens the conversation up so much more. So the being honest part is critical. We've already established how you're honest is the next component. But you know, so I would far rather be in that situation What it requires, people are sometimes dishonest because they're just lazy. They don't want to have that confrontation. They don't want to go through, well, let me tell you what you did wrong with this project and why you should have done it better. Because often what it'll lead back to is, if I'd given you better instructions right in the beginning, we may not be in this place. So I think being honest makes that come bubble to the to the surface really, really quickly. And so it that transparency is probably even a better word. That transparency is something that brings everything to light, whether I've done well or poorly or they've done well or poorly. And I think if we're sincere about the people we engage with, I'm really like – deliberate about the person who's in front of me. I really want to connect with them, be authentic. I think of you, James. You're a book, and I've just taken you out of the library and I've read you. And after I'm finished reading you, I'm going to put you away. I may never read you again, but I'm sure I'll think about you in a context somewhere or other. You may really impact me significantly. I remember chapters about you, but I want to be able to do that in a way with every person that I connect with. And so being honest, especially in the work environment and definitely in relationships, and I think quite honestly everywhere, it's critical to take the time and energy to figure out, am I going to be honest? How am I going to do that? Because you really are doing it. Well, let me say that this way. Because if you're doing it for the right reasons, it should be said.
So that leads me to actually the question number one, two, three. And that is then, you know, this idea of honesty then, how are you utilizing compassion or empathy?
Wow. Well, compassion and empathy, they kind of do go hand in hand. Yeah. I think if I think about empathy, it's a little bit different. Empathizing is
– there are differences, but I think people kind of will – so empathy is I understand how you feel, and that makes sense. And then compassion is how do you describe compassion? I would think of compassion as like – I don't know. How do you describe compassion?
Well, I don't know how I would differentiate it between with empathy much more than compassion. I feel like is understanding what someone's going through. Maybe the difference there is that I haven't gone through it. Empathy is something that I usually have experienced, and I don't know if that's the dictionary definition of it. And compassion, I think, is so yeah, maybe that's my definition of it. I don't know how accurate that is.
Hey, so actually I just popped it up while we're talking. Do you want me to tell you the differences?
Yes, because then I'll answer this much more.
Yeah. Because I was like, well, what is the difference? All right. So here we go. Compassion is not the same as empathy or altruism, though the concepts are related. While empathy refers to more generally to our ability to take the perspective of and feel the emotions of another person, compassion is when those feelings and thoughts include the desire to help. So compassion is taking the empathy and wanting to help someone. There we go.
So I'm very compassionate. I definitely, you know, when we have an opportunity, usually it's in a situation when you're talking about empathy and compassion, it's usually in a situation that's difficult that you're dealing with. And so I think taking the time to show people that you really care. That's where it all begins, that you really do care about what's going on, why they are, where they are, and being sincere about, well, let me see if I can help you, or pouring into them in some or other way. So we do that. The challenge definitely in modern society is how far do you take that, because there are all sorts of lines. My line and your line might be much further away than my line with somebody else, and we may cross that line much more quickly. So it's always a complicated place. But again, it depends a little bit on how you ask those questions, and people often invite some input.
That's awesome. All right, question four. I think this is a really important part of being a leader. So, you know,
do I need a dictionary?
No.
Okay, good.
Yeah, you know, that was an important conversation there between the two. I think that you tease it out, because I don't think many people fully understand the difference between the two. So, you know, I think being in the C-suite, being an authentic leader, it really requires you to be relatable to everybody. So how do you relate to the admin, to other C-suite executives? What tricks or tactics do you use?
Wow. Okay, well, I think one of the things that I've learned, and actually Julian, the name on the door, has said this before, and I really love this, but he said, be interesting and be interested. And so I think the combination of things we've spoken about before, being honest, being transparent, and being sincere with people goes a long way. When I'm connecting with the different teams that we have in our business, I'm always trying to live in that space. I'm also fortunate that I've gone through a number of different roles within this company. And so it's given me a sense of what other people's lives look like. Although I don't entirely understand what every role looks like, I have a sense. Having a real open door policy, please come in and talk to me. Let's figure this thing out together. You know that my heart is to figure this out for the best for the company, for the customers, and for you. I think that is a way that we've been really successful. But I really do think that if you're interested in who people are, what they're doing in their specific different roles, and you're you're interesting, it's always easier to have conversations.
I like that. I also think having the conversation to relate requires listening too. So, I'm really interested in you, and I want to hear what you have to say, and I'm going to listen to you, and that's where I'll form my questions to be curious.
It's so funny you push that button because that's the one I'm working on. Thank you for pointing that out. I'm definitely working on being a better listener, and it is crazy important. I couldn't agree with you more.
But I find that that's kind of a contradiction because you said that you really like to do interviews and you're a good interviewer. And that's all interviewing is, to me at least. It's just listening for the cues and words that you use.
Yeah, it's funny. So much of the interview, you said don't turn on the Skype video. So much of the interview is the cues that we get from body language and such.
That's true.
How often have you sat in the airport and read every single person that walked by you? Oh, this person, this person.
All right, let me get but we're going to run out of time, and I want to make sure I get enough time with you here. So I want to do question five because this is kind of the capper of the – not the capper. I overstated that. This is the final question. All right. question five, excuse me, I think is really important to all of this. How do you continually learn?
Honestly, I'm always learning, so that's a great question. I really have a somewhat – humble perspective on who I am and where I want to be, understanding that I'm on a journey. And so I really am always, I'm always reading. I'm always open to feedback. I listen to, even though I just said I'm not a great listener, I'm not a bad listener. I listen
what
to
your what wife people, say.
She says when it's the right conversation, I do listen. I just have to choose better, which is the right conversation. I can listen well.
Yeah. Self-determination. So, go ahead.
Yeah. So I think those I'm lucky to travel. I read, I pay attention to what's going around on around me. But I really believe that, the combination of all of those is probably the best way I could answer.
That's awesome. Well, Stephen, thank you for being authentic.
Thank you.
All right. So with the last time that I have with you here, and I've got about 5 to 10 minutes. What I want to do is talk about Julian Krinsky, the underpinnings of its success. And I go, most of my audience doesn't actually know much about it, but at least in the Philadelphia area and a little bit outside, it's a very, very successful camp. But it seems like it was founded around tennis. Is that correct?
Amazing. So Julian actually was a South African. I didn't know him when he was in South Africa. Played Wimbledon, played French, came over to America, an incredibly successful tennis player, accountant, lawyer, just altogether an amazing man. Entrepreneur, one thing leads to another, and he sees his tennis kids want to play golf. He starts a golf camp. Next thing, he looks at them and he says, you are really smart. Let me impart some entrepreneurial wisdom, and we start a business camp. We have 20-something different programs now, everything from medicine to fashion to robotics to public speaking. You can't imagine tennis, coding, business, it doesn't matter. And it's grown on the concept of kind of a pre-college experience, giving students from around the world the opportunity to spend a little bit of time on a college campus, which is a really powerful thing when you talk about the Gen Z and the Alpha Gen and why it's so important for them to get this kind of exposure. They get an opportunity to try on something new that they may not have tried before, whether it's, fashion design or whatever it is, or do an internship, which they may never have done. Or they get to say, I'm really interested in medicine and I'm really going to go deep into it. And so today we're at a place where we do that, and we partner with a bunch of the different universities to do different things. And so we have such a – if you look at think about it from a restaurant perspective, we have such an amazing menu of choices that you could look at us and say, wow, this is I could do all these things. And tennis, where we started, is still so much part of who we are, but it's such a small part of what we do in the summers. It's amazing.
Well, that's what I was going to say, and I feel like your business model is really predicated from June to August.
Right.
So isn't that kind of leveraging very heavily on one source of revenue?
Well, surely. That's why we totally have to do it well. We have to stay connected, and we're a people business. We have to stay connected with our people, which are Gen Z currently. We've got to know what they're interested in. We've got to also tease out of not only what they're interested in, but we've got to tease out ways of delivering that content to them in a way that is compelling, exciting, stretches them, gives them opportunities to grow, and also present it from a marketing perspective in a way that parents, when they look at it, say, ah, this could be something that's really amazing for our kids. And so, you know, the venues that we're at are amazing. We've been at Haverford, as you mentioned, for 40 years, which is a spectacular space. And, you know, we're always morphing and doing different things. I think the universities are – just about every university is open to people using their spaces in the summer. It's a way of leveraging income for the universities. Sure. So – you know, it's very important to have our eggs in multiple baskets, you know, just for whatever reason. But the model is predicated on us doing well every single day and not worrying how well we did yesterday.
So what happens if summer 2017, you start to see numbers drop and camp stop being the thing you do in the summer? Like what's the what if statement after that?
Yeah, you morph or die. And then so, right?
Sorry.
You look at what's going on and you say, well, I'm not going to accept this. I know that there's a way that I can be relevant in the conversation of the students that we love spending time with, and you figure out a different way to present attract them. And the truth is that we are doing that on an ongoing basis. We have a couple of programs that we're busy developing. When the students come to us this summer, we're going to be asking them about, what do you think about this idea we're launching next year? And so, you know, if it did ever happen where all of a sudden the bottom falls out, you know, we do have a couple of other businesses that are attached to the group. So we do have our tennis clubs and we do have some properties that we're involved with. But the truth of the matter is, I hope to see that sign 3 years before it happens. Mm-hmm. And if I don't, what I said to you earlier, I need to think with – I've got an amazing team. So we really have an amazing team. We're looking at this all the time. We're already planning for 18 and 19, even though summer hasn't even begun for 17 yet. So we're really looking at that. We're always looking at the numbers and what students are interested in. So I hope that's good enough. But if there's a crisis event, you know, that's what makes us shine, how we deal with the crisis.
Well, I mean, I think you hit it on the head. You guys are in the customer service business. I mean, at the end of the day, yes, your customers are a bunch of teenage kids. And if you're making them happy and they're having a good experience, not only are they happy, but the parents are happy at that point as well. And so the return on participation, I guess the return clientele, I imagine could be quite high as you go. And then you have the other side of it too, where you have to take care of the counselors. So if the counselors are also having a positive experience, then for them, they also use the word of mouth as their tactic to get more counselors as well.
Oh, well said. I mean, honestly, that's where our core focus is. Our staff are actually literally arriving as we speak. And so we spend more than a week really pouring into them, refining, explaining to them, showing them what our culture looks and feels like, because they're the ones that deliver it to the students. And so our focus is heavily from the, you know, we have about 35 full-time people that are in our different, that are full-time, not just in the camps and the programs, but it's their responsibility to take who we are and what we do and how we do it and make sure that the staff that are seasonal catch the vision, because they're the ones that are engaging with the students on a much greater level than we're able to. And so, as you just rightly said, they are the word of mouth, not only for other staff, but they're also the people that are delivering this amazing experience that we're every year trying to do.
So, you know, as you were talking about planning out 18, 19, I mean, is there any innovation that you guys are trying to create because this is kind of, I mean, summer camps are quite competitive. Do you guys see yourself as a premium camp? As, you know, like I feel like you guys are kind of priced in a premium position.
I believe we are. I think what people often don't realize is the cost of running a program at a university is almost like a hotel. So you have to pay for every meal, every student. Whereas if you're a traditional program living in the woods somewhere, you have a bunk. It doesn't matter if you have three or five kids, and the difference in food isn't such a big deal. But we are a premium-based program in the sense that we have two sets of staff. So we have professors and professionals that are teaching the students, and then we have a separate set of staff that are residential RAs looking after them. So yeah, we are priced quite premium priced. There's no doubt about that in the experience. We do. There are scholarship opportunities, and we do. It's not just a financial thing. So we do reach out to people in other socioeconomic kind of situations and try and make sure that they're part of who we are as well.
So yeah, I think one thing that I always think about is, you know, similar to colleges, right? At what point is the price too high? At what point, you know, because you guys have such an international, you know, mix. So now you're also paying for flights. And then you're paying you know, the travel to the event and then travel back to the event. And so, like, it ends up being quite expensive 2 weeks because most of these events are, like, 2 weeks at a time.
Yeah. So you could stay for any range of weeks. And you're 100% correct. And I think being a camp in what we'd call the specialty camp arena as opposed to – we focus on very specific things. So being in that space, what we really – we can't solve for every problem. Mm-hmm. So we can't solve for the cost. We can't. And so that's the market that we're in. And so what we really work on is making sure that what we leave you with.
You're an experience.
And that it's a valuable experience. You know, an opportunity to not only have some cross-cultural competency, but some virtual collaboration to come and be a part of a creator in a space. And we also really focus on some of the soft skills. So, you know, the chef that you have teaching you cooking or the internship that you go to will be an exceptional experience. But we also are teaching the Gen Z these soft skills that our generation had in abundance and they don't have in the same way. And that's a lot around community, engaging with one another, starting to teach them skills about when they get into the marketplace, how to go through an interview if you're being interviewed by a Gen Xer or baby boomer and how they see you. And so those collaboration, community type skills, I think are critical. And what we're trying to say to a parent is this we really believe is an investment. Mm-hmm. You're investing in this entire experience. And yeah, there's some really hard skills in terms of learning about medicine while you're with us, but you're on a college campus. You've got this cross-cultural competency thing going and with kids from all over. We're also teaching you to integrate, to socialize, to be part of a community. And so that's part of what we really believe in. So yeah, there's a price tag for that, I guess.
Yeah. Well, I mean, so I could ask 20 questions, but the reality is I need to ask you one more question and then we got to wrap. So this has been an awesome conversation. So my final question to you, Stephen Robertson, is how do you, for where you're at in your life, how do you define happiness?
Wow. So there's so many things I think that come into happiness. I'm quite a spiritual fellow, so there's one component. But I think I find happiness out of, I guess I'd call it attitude. My attitude to life and to day-to-day things is how am I going to engage and interact with every situation that comes my way? And I can choose to sulk about something or mope and groan about it, or I can choose to use things as a learning experience. And so over the years, I've really grown in that way. And so I find that I'm generally very happy. There are very few things that frustrate or irritate me. And when I do get frustrated or irritated, it's just for a moment. And then I take a step back and realize that this is part of a journey that I'm traveling. And it's part of a journey that one day when I look back from a certain place, I will have got to that certain place because of where I've been. Clearly, friends, family, that community are all really big parts of what makes me happy. But I guess there's many things that come into it. And if I had to just pick one thing, I say my attitude to life, I think, is what helps me be happy and who I am and where I am.
I think, you know what's really fascinating about that is that a lot of people who I've asked this question to that I truly believe are happy, aren't selling me a line of bullshit, say it's a state. It's a state that I choose to have, right? Okay. Meaning your attitude. It's a state. I choose to have this attitude. I choose to have this outlook.
Right.
And I think that's a really important learning from anyone who struggles with what happiness is or is not. And it's just it's a state. You know, again, you ebb and flow, no doubt. You're not always happy, but it's a state and it's an outlook. Okay. So do you agree with that?
I do. I hadn't thought about it like that and even the context of the word you used, but I really do. I yes, 100%. Okay.
Well, Stephen Robertson, thank you for your time, energy, willingness to sit down with me on Executives After Hours.
It's been such a pleasure. I could not wait to connect with you, and you are such fun to be with.
Thank you.